Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday, October 29th, 2023. My name is Bill McCann, and I'll begin with a featured story in the magazine, Climate Change is Keeping Therapists Up at Night. How anxiety about the planet's future is transforming the practice of psychotherapy. This is a story by Brooke Jarvis. Andrew Bryant can still remember when he thought of climate change as primarily a problem of the future. When he heard or read about troubling impacts, he found himself setting them in 2080, a year that, not so coincidentally, would be a century after his own birth. The changing climate and all the challenges it would bring were scary and sad, he said recently, but so far in the future that I'd be safe. That was back when things were different, in the long-ago world of 2014 or so. The Pacific West, Northwest, where Brian is a clinical social worker and psychotherapist treating patients in private practice in Seattle, is a largely affluent place that was once considered a potential refuge from climate disruption. Climate change sometimes came up in therapy sessions in the context of other issues, say a couple having arguments because they couldn't decide if it was still ethical to have kids, but it was rare and usually fairly theoretical. We're lucky to be buffered by wealth and location, Bryant said. We're lucky to have the opportunity to look away. The smoke was the first sign that things were starting to change. People who live in the coastal Northwest often joke that the brief, beautiful bluebird summers are the reason everyone puts up with so many months of chilly gloom. But starting in the mid-2010s, those beloved blue skies began to disappear. First, the smoke came in occasional bursts from wildfires in Canada, or California, or Siberia, and blew away when the wind changed direction. Within a few summers, though, it was coming in thicker, from more directions at once, and lasting longer. The sun turned blood red or was all but blotted out, disappearing along with the city's skyline. The sky turned gray or sepia or eerily tangerine, and ash floated down like snow. Sometimes there were weeks when you were advised not to open your windows or exercise outside. Sometimes there were long stretches when you weren't supposed to breathe the outside air at all. Now lots of Brian's clients wanted to talk about climate change. They wanted to talk about how strange and disorienting and scary this new reality felt, about what the future might be like and how they might face it, about how to deal with all the strong feelings, helplessness, rage, depression, guilt being stirred up inside them. As a therapist, Brian found himself unsure how to respond. He grew up deeply interested in science and nature. He was a biology major before his fascination with human behavior turned him towards social work, but he always thought of those interests as separate from the profession he would eventually choose. And while his clinical education offered lots of training in, say, substance abuse or family therapy, there's nothing about environmental crisis or how to treat patients whose mental health was affected by it. He began reaching out to other counselors who had similar stories. They came from a variety of clinical backgrounds and orientations, but none of their training had covered issues like climate change or environmental anxiety. Bryant immersed himself in the subject, joining and founding associations of climate-concerned therapists. The Pacific Northwest, after all, was hardly alone in seeing scary new impacts, and lots of places were experiencing far worse. He searched for emerging research on the intersection of climate change and psychology, which was scattered across a variety of fields and journals, and eventually started a website, Climate and Mind, to serve as a sort of clearinghouse for other therapists searching for resources. Instead, the site became an unexpected window into the experience of would-be patients. Bryant found himself receiving messages from people around the world who stumbled across it while looking for help. Over and over, he read the same story of potential patients who'd gone looking for someone to talk about climate change and other environmental crises, only to be told that they were overreacting, that their concern, not the climate, was what was out of whack and in need of treatment. This was a story common enough to have become a joke, another therapist told me. You come in and talk about how anxious you are that fossil fuel companies continue to pump CO2 into the air, and your therapist says, "So, tell me about your mother." In many of the messages, people ask Bryant for referrals to climate-focused therapists in Houston or Canada or Taiwan, wherever it was the writer lived. He found himself apologizing repeatedly. "I can't," he'd write. "The field doesn't really exist yet." But it was clear to him that the messages, like the smoke, were a sign of a bigger change on the way. By 2021, when the Northwest suffered through a shocking heat wave that melted infrastructure, killed hundreds of people, and scorched millions of evergreen trees, the symbol of the region's now fragile lushness, his practice had shifted to reflect a new reality of climate psychology. His clients didn't just bring up the changing climate incidentally or during disconcerting local reminders. Rather, many were activists or scientists or people who specifically sought out Bryant because of their concerns about the climate crisis. The sorts of people who, not so long ago, had cold emailed him about their struggle to find treatment could now turn to resources like the list maintained by the Climate Psychology Alliance North America, which contains nearly 300 psychotherapists around the country who are what the organization calls climate aware. "It had been a challenging few years," Bryant told me when I first called to talk about his work. "There were some ways in which climate fears were a natural fit in the therapy room, and he believed the field had coalesced around some answers that felt clear and useful. But treating those fears also stirred up lots of complicated questions that no one was quite sure how to answer. The traditional focus of his field," Bryant said, "could be oversimplified as fixing the individual, treating patients as separate entities working on their personal growth. Climate change, by contrast, was a species-wide problem, a profound and constant reminder of how deeply intertwined we all are in complex systems, atmospheric, biospheric, economic, that are much bigger than us. It sometimes felt like a direct challenge to old therapeutic paradigms, and perhaps a chance to replace them with something better." And one of climate psychology's founding papers, published in 2011, Susan Clayton and Thomas J. Dougherty posited that climate change would have, quote, "significant negative effects on mental health and well-being." They described three broad types of possible impacts: the acute trauma of living through climate disasters, the corroding fear of a collapsing future, and the psychosocial decay that could damage the fabric of communities dealing with disruptive changes. All of these, they wrote, would make the climate crisis, quote, "as much a psychological and social phenomenon as a matter of biodiversity and geophysics." Many of these predictions have since been borne out. Studies have found rates of PTSD spiking in the wake of disasters. And in 2017, the American Psychological Association defined eco-anxiety as a chronic fear of environmental doom. Climate-driven migration is on the rise, and so are stories of xenophobia and community mistrust. According to a 2022 survey by Yale and George Mason University, a majority of Americans report that they spend time worrying about climate change. Many say it has led to symptoms of depression and anxiety. More than a quarter make an active effort not to think about it. A poll by the American Psychiatric Association in the same year found that nearly half of Americans think climate change is already harming the nation's mental health. In June, the Yale Journal of Biology and Medicine published a paper cautioning that the world at large was facing, quote, a psychological condition of systemic uncertainty, in which difficult emotions arise not only from experiencing the ecological loss itself, but also from the fact that our lives are inescapably embedded in systems that keep on making those losses worse. Climate change, in other words, surrounds us with constant reminders of, quote, ethical dilemmas and deep social criticism of modern society. In its essence, climate crisis questions the relationship of humans with nature and the meaning of being human in the Anthropocene. This is not an easy way to live. Human well-being, the psychologist David W. Kidner wrote, has historically been linked to participation in a healthy eco-culture context. Living within a context that is obviously unhealthy, he wrote, is painful, a dimly intuited fall from which we spend our lives trying to recover, a guilt we can never quite grasp or expiate, a feeling of loss or dislocation whose true origins we look for but often fail to see. This confusion leaves us feeling even worse. When Barbara Easterlin first started studying environmental psychology 30 years ago, she told me the focus of study was on ways in which cultivating a relationship with nature can be good for mental health. There was little or no attention to the fact that living through or helping to cause a collapse of nature can also be mentally harmful. Today, Easterlin, a clinical psychologist, is working on developing training courses in climate therapy for the CPA, NA, and elsewhere. But she cautions that the field is still so new that it doesn't yet have evidence-tested treatments or standards of practice. Therapists sometimes feel as if they're finding the path as they go. Bryant recalls feeling uncertain about how to react when, even on the smokiest days, with the air quality index so high you couldn't see to the end of the block, patients would walk into his office and simply fail to mention the toxic haze outside the door. It was such a notable omission that, like other therapists I spoke to, he began to wonder if he should bring up climate change as a way of encouraging people to recognize feelings from which they may have been hiding. Bryant still isn't sure of the right approach, but he has begun to make a point of seeding conversations with possible openings. Holding that reality, my environment is harmful and I'm trying to live in it, takes so much energy, he said. But until the language of eco-anxiety enters the conversation, lots of people don't think of it as something to bring up. Rebecca Weston, a licensed clinical social worker practicing in New York and a co-president of the CPA-NA, told me that when she treats anxiety disorders, her goal is often to help the patient understand how much of their fear is internally produced, out of proportion to the reality they're facing. But climate anxiety is a different challenge because people worried about climate change and environmental breakdown are often having the opposite experience. Their worries are rational and evidence-based, but they feel isolated and frustrated because they're living in a society that tends to dismiss them. One of the emerging tenets of climate psychology is that counselors should validate their clients' climate-related emotions as reasonable, not pathological. This doesn't mean confirming particular predictions or scenarios. They're therapists, not climate scientists, or amplifying existing fears, but it does mean validating that feelings like grief, fear, and shame aren't a form of sickness, but as Weston put it, are actually rational responses to a world that's very scary, very uncertain, and very dangerous for people. In the words of a handbook on climate psychology, quote, paying heed to what is happening in our communities and across the globe is a healthier response than turning away in denial or disavowal. But this too raises difficult questions. How much do we normalize people to the system we're in? Weston asked. And is that the definition of health? Or is the definition of health resisting the things that are making us so unhappy? That's the profound tension within our field. One recent afternoon, I logged into Zoom and watched my computer screen fill with faces. They belong to members of the Alliance of Climate Therapists Northwest, a group that Bryant organized with Bob Burley, another therapist who found that his patients wanted to talk about climate change. Part support group, part study group, the Alliance included established therapists with decades of practice, as well as others who were still working through their education or internships. It was meant to provide a way for therapists to gather, talk about the questions that were bubbling up in their meetings with patients, to figure out, as Brian put it, how to do this work. Seems to shift all the time, sort of content and material that people are bringing in. Alexandra Wolocott, a psychotherapist in Seattle, told the group. Sometimes it was a pervasive anxiety about the future, or trauma responses to fires or smoke or heat. Other times, clients, especially young ones, wanted to vent their sort of righteous anger, sense of betrayal at the various powers that had built and maintained a society that was so destructive. I'm so glad that we have each other to process this, she said, because we're humans living through this too. I have my own trauma responses to it. I have my own grief process around it. I have my own fury at our government and oil companies, and I think I don't want to burden my clients with my own emotional response to it. I had a client recently say, "Oh, I'm so sorry to burden you with all of my client anxiety," Zoe Rogers, a clinical psychologist, said in response. And I was like, "No, it's okay. I'm in it with you." In a field that has long emphasized boundaries, discouraging therapists from bringing their own issues or experiences into the therapy room, climate therapy offers a particular challenge. Separation can be harder when the problems at hand affect therapist and client alike. Some therapists I spoke to were worried about navigating the breakdown of barriers, while others had embraced it. There's no place on the planet that won't eventually be impacted, where client and therapist won't be in it together, family therapist wrote in a CPA-NA newsletter. Most therapists I know have become more vulnerable and self-disclosing in their practice. On the Zoom, Annie Dwyer, is still a counselor in training, told the group that she had been thinking about how to apply traditional trauma treatments to environmental losses. While therapy is often centered on helping people move mentally away from the feelings of danger they experienced in the past into the safer world of the present, that formula doesn't apply to living with an ongoing threat or feeling grief over a loss that never stops. If you look at or consider typical theoretical framings of something like post-traumatic growth, which is the understanding of this idea that people can sort of grow and become stronger, better after a traumatic event, she said, then the climate crisis poses a dilemma because, quote, there's no afterwards, right? There's no resolution any time in our lifetimes to this crisis that we nonetheless have to build the capacities to face and to endure and to hopefully engage. How, she asked, do you think about resilience apart from resolution? Nicole Torres, who practices in Bellingham, Washington, told the group that she sometimes tells her clients about her first time seeing the sky full of stars after growing up in New York City. She had no idea there were so many. She believes many of her clients are also disconnected from the natural world, which means that they struggle to process or even to recognize the grief and alienation that comes from living in a society that treats nature as other, a resource to be used and discarded. I'm so excited by what you're bringing in, Wallacott replied. I'm doing psychoanalytic training at the moment, and we study attachment theory, how the stability of early emotional bonds affects future relationships and feelings of well-being. But nowhere in the literature does it talk about our attachment to the land. Tori said that she sometimes takes her therapy sessions outside or asks patients to remember their earliest and deepest connections with animals or plants or places. She believes it will help if they learn to think of themselves as rooted beings that aren't just simply living in the human overlay on the environment. It was valuable to recognize, she said, that we are part of the land and suffer when it suffers. The conversation was flowing enthusiastically after some people spoke about introducing their clients to methods, mindfulness, distress tolerance, emotion regulation to help manage feelings of stress or panic and avoid burnout. Torres pointed out that many of her clients struggle with existential and quality of life issues that cannot be easily solved through a mere intervention. She also encourages them to narrativize the problem, including themselves as agents of change inside stories about how they came to be in the situation and how they might make it different. And then she encourages them to find a community of other people who care about the same problems, with whom they would connect outside the therapy room. As Wallacott said earlier, people who share your values, people who are committed to not looking away. Dwyer told the group that she'd been thinking more about psychological adaptation as a form of climate mitigation, not so different from seawalls or ruggedized power grids. Therapy, she said, could be a way to steward human energy and creative capacities at a time when they're most needed. It was hard, Ryan told me when we first spoke, to do this sort of work without finding yourself asking bigger questions, namely, what was therapy actually about? Many of the therapists I talked to spoke of their role not as fixing a patient's problem or responding to a pathology, but simply giving their patient the tools to name and explore their most difficult emotions, to sit with painful feelings without instantly running away from them. For this, they found many of the methods in their traditional toolkits continue to be useful in climate psychology. Anxiety and hopelessness and anger are all familiar territory, after all, with long histories of well-studied treatments. Plus, people bring their own issues and patterns to the particularities of the climate crisis. Hypervigilant, doom-scrolling if they have control issues, perhaps, or falling into despondency if they have a tendency toward depression. And in defiance of the joke, sometimes it's still helpful to talk about your mother. They focus on trying to help patients develop coping skills and find meaning amid destabilization, to still see themselves as having agency and choice. Weston, the therapist in New York, has had patients who struggle to be in a world that surrounds them with waste and trash, who experience panic because they can never find a place free of reminders of their society's destruction. She, like Bryant, has worked with couples who fought over whether it was ethical to have children in the face of all that is at risk. In her experience, patients from more privileged backgrounds were more likely to resist the idea, while those from communities with a long history of other traumas, destabilization, were more open. They were used to seeing life go on even amid threats that could feel existential. This was one reason, Weston said, that she has trouble with the repeated refrain that therapist and patient experiencing the same losses and dreads at the same time constituted a major departure from traditional therapeutic practice. Though it was important to think carefully about boundaries between patient and therapist and their erasure, she believed this framing reflected and reinforced a bias inherent in a field that has long been most accessible to and practiced by the privileged. It was hardly new in the world, after all, to face the collapse of your entire way of life and still find ways to keep going. Lately, Bryant told me, he's been most excited about the work that happens outside the therapy room, places where groups of people gather to talk about their feelings and the future they're facing. It was at such a meeting, a community event where people were brainstorming ways to adapt to climate chaos, that Weston, realizing she had concrete skills to offer, was inspired to rework her practice to focus on the challenge. She remembers finding the gathering empowering and energizing in a way she hadn't experienced before. In such settings, it was automatic that people would feel embraced instead of isolated, natural that the conversation would start moving away from the individual and toward collective experiences and ideas. There was no fully separate space to be mended on its own. There was only a shared and broken world and a community united in loving it. Brooke Jarvis is a contributing writer for the magazine. She last wrote about the fight for the right to roam England. And now I'll read a letter of recommendation. Stop before you close this tab or any others. Think of your browser like an ongoing autobiography. Why would you ever delete it? The story by Ali Jaffe Ramos. Whenever my computer freezes and shuts down, I'm not surprised. I have a tab problem. As I'm writing this, I currently have 72 browser tabs open. My email, my calendar, the dinner menu of the restaurant where I'm meeting a friend tonight, directions for how to get there, and order confirmation for a refill of Sonicare toothbrush heads, my local yoga studio's weekly schedule, medical claims forms, Ina Garten's lemon orzo recipe to make this weekend. My phone, meanwhile, has no fewer than 263 open tabs. These tabs reflect what's on my mind. They contain my agenda and provide answers to the mundane questions that demand my attention. How tall is Paul Giamatti? Are wine glasses dishwashers safe? Some of them, long-form articles I've been meaning to read, skincare products I can't afford, an 8-session pottery class that I swear I'll take when I have the time, trailers for movies I'll never have time to see, the Wikipedia entries for dog breeds I don't own or would like to, shoes I probably won't buy but am considering because they are or more likely were on sale, tell a story about the kind of person I aspire to be. Some are reminders of things I don't want to forget, like the real estate listing for the Sheepshead Bay apartment my grandma grew up in, or parking tickets I need to pay. Browser tabs have been around since the 1990s. Their creation is credited both to a firm called BookLink Technologies, which created a tabbed browser called Internet Works in 1994, and a software developer named Adam Stiles, who in 1998 released a separate browser called Simulbrowse. Stiles was initially inspired to design tabs when he was using an HTML editor that allowed him to flip between documents. He wanted the same intuitive capability on his web browser. The convenience and organizational benefits of having all your web pages collected with the ability to toggle among them became obvious, and by the 2000s, tabbed browsing was the standard. Whatever the inventors intended us to do with tabs, they probably couldn't have imagined how emotionally attached to our tabs we would become. A recent study examining internet tab usage found that 25% of respondents experienced crashing browsers multiple times a week because they had so many tabs open at the same time. You may be reading this right now on what feels like your zillionth tab. When I sit down at my computer, the first thing I do is open my browser and see all my tabs lined up neatly for me. It feels soothing, as if I'm shrinking the infinitely vast internet into a familiar neighborhood. I go in looking for directions to the Korean restaurant my friend wants to try, and the next thing I know, I've clicked on another tab, and I'm looking at concert tickets for an indie rock band from the early aughts that is touring again. Sometimes I click through my tabs just to remind myself what's there. Oh, right, you old friend. I let my tabs build up until they are tiny little squares squished together and their identifying logos are almost too small to make out. I open a new window only when I want to separate a group of related tabs to keep myself focused. That's rare, though. I prefer working among the chaos of all my tabs, where my method to the madness is that I know, mostly, where everything is. I'll often spend hours on the internet and not close a single tab before I shut my laptop. To close a tab means to celebrate a mission accomplished or saying goodbye to a desire I've outgrown or an opportunity I've let expire. Some people get stressed out by too many tabs. They have a valid point. Science has proved again and again that multitasking reduces productivity. It's distracting to have little winking reminders of everything else you'd rather be doing at that than the task at hand. At this point, though, tabs feel like an extension of myself. If my computer suffers a surprise restart, the first thing I do when it boots back up is click Restore All Tabs. For a split second, I wonder anxiously if they're gone forever, along with all that time I spent curating my personal internet and all those valuable, if forgettable, web pages lost to the void of cyberspace. Once they're gone, I won't be able to find them again. They're little parts of me, my desires, memories, goals, that I'm scared to forget. But they usually reload and they breathe a sigh of relief. Maybe a part of me longs for the pre-social media days of Web 2.0, the delightfully random stumble upon chat rooms and the strange and surprising Reddit that I used in high school. In my head, exploring the internet via a browser creates a more concrete experience than scrolling through platforms like X or Instagram, where algorithmically tailored content yields paradoxically impersonal results. Of course, that algorithmic infrastructure powers everything about our online experience today. But I cherish my tabs because they remind me of a simpler time and give me a sense of control and ownership. They make me feel like there are tiny pieces of the web that are mine. Would you scroll through a friend's browser tabs without permission? Probably not. It's as much a violation of privacy as looking through a friend's journal. After all, few things are more personal than the things we admit only to our search bar. Ali Thafi Ramis is a segment producer at The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Now I'll read the Screenland section of the magazine. Why the Golden Bachelor terrifies me. Television celebrates older people, but only for seeming like sexy young ones. This is a story by Muriel Silkoff. In the first episode of ABC's The Golden Bachelor, the new 60-plus addition to the decades-old Bachelor franchise, Jerry Turner, 72, puts in his hearing aids, dons a tuxedo, and cries within the first 3 minutes of airtime. Jerry, our Golden Bachelor, has been widowed for 6 years. His wife, Toni, died suddenly of an infection. And in describing her passing, he cannot contain his grief. We see photos of their lives together, from young marrieds to parents, from middle-aged partners to retirees enjoying themselves on a boat. Jerry is uncommonly slim and good-looking and seems to have been so throughout these various life stages. Tony, whose age is not specified, ages less magically. Her waist and eyeglasses thicken, as these things tend to do. And clearly these changes didn't dampen Jerry's adoration. The type of tears he sheds on camera over her passing reveal what looks like a deep and enduring love, the thing every contestant on the set of The Golden Bachelor is now competing to find with him. Like the original, The Golden Bachelor presents around 24 women, all vying for lasting happiness through marriage to a single eligible catch. Other than the fact that contestants range in age from 60 to 75, the formula is familiar. Like The Bachelor, the season aims to end with a proposal. Like The Bachelor, most action takes place in a mansion full of bunk beds. Like The Bachelor, the contestants are typically lithe, sexy, and hyperactive. Some wear stilettos to breakfast, along with tube tops and hot pants and all manner of plunging décolletage. There are boobs everywhere, often huge ones. As the contestants emerge from their limousines one by one near the start of the first episode, making grand entrances with their mermaid hair and Pilates, abs and buns of steel and snatched cheekbones and pneumatic-looking hip lips, often all over Jerry within minutes, a truth seems to dawn on the septuagenarian widower. Older women are not what they used to be. They're nothing at all like what they used to be. As if to underline this point, one of the contestants emerges from her limo with a curler, set gray hair, baggy dress, and walker, only to rip the whole kit off, fling the walker onto the paving stones, and reveal her true self. This is Leslie, a 64-year-old dancer and former aerobics champion in a tiny lace corseted mini dress. Leslie looks about 40 and acts even younger. The show, of course, is fun to watch. Many of the women are beautiful and spirited and accomplished. Jerry seems like a lovely man. Still, there's something here that sends a chill down my spine. The show has received glowing coverage from Predictable Corners, USA Today, and scored huge ratings for ABC. But is any of it actually good for older people or even for younger people? I mean, this is The Bachelor, a mainstay of reality TV. A certain amount of desperation, superficiality is built into the DNA of the genre. But plunging older people into this context and then valorizing them because perhaps with some nipping and tucking they can just about fit, this feels more like a denigration of aging. Some of these people have been on Earth for 75 years. Here is an opportunity for them to demonstrate that life, comfortingly, has many chapters, and that there's always change, and that this change is not only natural, but good. Instead, we get a tight and toned show in which success involves being able to repeat chapter 3 for as long as possible. This version of freedom has nothing to do with wisdom or respite, with taking stock or giving back or the hard-won sucker of age. It's about working extremely hard to remain the same as you were when you were younger, or maybe even more fabulously youthy, especially if that youthful you was wont to grind bare-legged to Don't Stop Believin' in a tinsel handkerchief dress. A state of nubile teenagehood already coats the age spectrum from 8-year-olds with gel nails on Snapchat to middle-aged dads in hoodies on longboards. Now it's creeping even further up the lifespan. Martha Stewart expanded from her cardigans and sheet pan suppers to mue on TikTok and chit-chat on talk shows about how she should date Pete Davidson. Madonna accuses critics of ageism as she rids her face and body of signs of time to the point of looking like a different person. The idea of not aging is not only normalized, but treated as an accomplishment. No surprise, then, that one Golden Bachelor contestant shows up on a motorcycle, or that another, age 70, flashes Jerry her birthday suit upon meeting him, or that everyone stays up all night dancing in skyscraper heels, apparently bunion and sciatica free, other than the odd passing remark about ear candy, code for hearing aids, or taking the bed nearest to the bathroom. This show, sold as a showcase for how fabulous and free growing old can be, and how it's never too late to find love, actually negates aging, erases lateness. More than 10,000 baby boomers turn 65 in America every day. By 2034, there'll be more Americans over 65 than children. What we are being told is that they will be vital and relevant, mostly insofar as they have maintained arms like Jessica Biel and off the charts libidos. A couple of weeks ago, I watched a few episodes of the 1980s sitcom The Golden Girls with my daughters. Like any other woman of 50 who knows how old these mostly gray-haired characters were supposed to be at the start of the series, Blanche, Dorothy, and Rose were in their early 50s. I experienced some cognitive dissonance. Do they seem like they're the same age as me? I asked my 11-year-old. No, she said. They seem more comfortable, like grandmothers used to. Odd, but true. The kind of aging depicted on The Golden Bachelor is itchy and awkward. We hear a contestant say it's nice to see older women enjoy how they feel in their skin. We hear contestants say they're breaking stereotypes of what it means to be old. But what good is that when those stereotypes are instantly replaced with girls gone wild stereotypes about what it means to still be young? In episode one, after most of the contestants have sashayed into the mansion, another woman emerges. She's 84. She's wearing a nice blouse and forgiving trousers and flat shoes, like a normal person in her 80s. She says she is Jimmy Kimmel's aunt, Aunt Chippy, as featured on his show, and she just wanted to meet Jerry, as she was sure he was lying about his age. The gag is that she is not really in the game, because she is old. Sitting with the other women in the mansion, she says, "I don't belong here. Those ladies are really something. Look at this one. I'm in the wrong place." She is later caught napping. At least one person here is comfortable with where she finds herself. But of course, Chippy leaves the set. I imagine her going home, making coffee, putting her feet up, calling a grandkid or an old friend to talk about the truly weird day she had and how, thank God, she doesn't need to be like that anymore, with the hair and the boobs and the sex, because she was already young once. And even then, it was exhausting. And now, she can't even imagine. I'll read a letter to the ethicists. "My son poses a threat to my safety. Should I evict him?" The magazine's ethicist columnist on whether parental responsibility should outweigh a person's well-being. And the ethicist is Kwame Anthony Appiah. And the reader writes, "I'm a nearly 70-year-old single mother living with an adult son of 40 who has schizoaffective disorder, which is a combination of schizophrenia and bipolar conditions. I testified at a jury trial that for over 10 years, he's been averse to staying on antipsychotic meds, and that as a result, he's been jailed, and that he has attacked me repeatedly in outbursts of rage. But Two of 12 jurors didn't agree that my son should be obliged to stay on meds. As a result, he has just been released from a medication mandate. Now, for the umpteenth time, distant family members are urging me to boot my mentally disabled son out of the apartment we share. My son is brilliant, with a genius IQ. He's also very loving when he's on his meds. Off his meds, he's a real menace and a threat to both my day-to-day peace of mind and my physical safety. But if I evict him, he'll be homeless and destitute. I believe that it's morally wrong to put a mentally disabled person out on the streets to fend for themselves. I further believe that a parent must look after her disabled child. But now that's at the risk of my own peace of mind and safety, and perhaps my life. What's the right choice? And the ethicist writes, the court decision, which was in your son's favor, though evidently not in his interest, held that your son must be treated as an autonomous person responsible for his own life. One way of abiding by that decision would be to tell him that he can stay with you only while he's on his meds. You wouldn't be evicting him. You would simply be putting reasonable terms on his accommodation. Through the court system, it appears he successfully resisted involuntary treatment. That was the decision he made. Now he can decide to take measures that would keep a roof over his head. Or he can decide not to. I know that it's often hard to persuade people to stay on their medications. To go by the research I've seen, perhaps half or more of patients with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, or schizoaffective disorder are non-adherent. Many of them don't like the side effects of drugs. Some prefer being manic to being medicated. And your son's condition may well mean that your son is in an especially poor position to see that he's better off medicated. In a lucid moment, he might agree to start a long-acting injectable easing adherence. That's a form of what scholars sometimes call self-binding, in which our present self puts constraints on our future self. So is getting a mortgage, so we bind our future selves all the time. Please be clear that you're not obliged to look after him at the risk of your life and health. And besides, if you're incapacitated, he'll be worse off too. Expelling him from your home if he refuses treatment isn't a way of punishing your son for defiance. It's a way of protecting yourself from danger. If he ends up jailed again, he could be deemed a threat to himself and to others, and another cycle of involuntary treatment could start. Alas, your son's keen intellect may help him secure what he wants at the expense of what he needs. I'll read another letter to the ethicist. Is it okay to hire a surrogate to bear twins? The magazine's ethicist columnist on the financial realities of family planning. And the reader writes, my husband and I want to have children, and as a gay couple, we think that surrogacy is our most realistic option. Surrogacy, however, is expensive. It could easily cost between $150,000 and $200,000 per pregnancy. We could afford two rounds, but this would deplete nearly all of our savings. We're well off, but don't come from especially affluent backgrounds, and it took a long time to accumulate these savings. These savings, in part, are for our future retirement, too. The issue is that we would like to have two children. One option is to aim for twins in the first round. However, we know that the risk of complications is significantly higher with a twin pregnancy, and the health of our future babies and the surrogate is very important to us. Is it ethical to try to get twins, even though we could afford, though not comfortably, to lower the risk for the children and have two singletons instead? We would be devastated if we ended up with twins who have health issues. And the ethicist writes, most twins and their mothers end up just fine. But you raise the right issues concerning the relative increase in risk to surrogate and children. A majority of twins are delivered preterm, which raises the likelihood of a variety of health problems, and birth defects are much more frequent than they are with singletons. Among people carrying twins, the rate of preeclampsia, a condition marked by hypertension, is 2 or 3 times higher than it is with those with singletons, and the severity tends to be greater too. Carrying twins also elevates the risk for gestational diabetes, and about half of those affected will later develop type 2 diabetes. Placental abruption, anemia, and postpartum hemorrhage. As I'm sure you know, the ethical status of compensated surrogacy is itself highly contested. It's not legally sanctioned anywhere in Western Europe. Surrogacy here refers to both to gestational surrogacy, in which the surrogate is not the biological mother of the child, and the traditional surrogacy, in which she is. My own view is that great care should be taken to avoid exploitation, but that under the right conditions, a woman should have the choice to enter into such an arrangement. What about trying for twins? In light of the risk, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, a professional organization that promulgates clinical and ethical guidelines for assisted reproduction, urges that measures be taken during in vitro fertilization to avoid pregnancies with 2 or more fetuses. Indeed, many reputable clinicians would simply decline to do what you're contemplating, for good reason. Paying a surrogate to carry twins, intentionally creating a higher risk pregnancy, in contravention of medical recommendations, would be wrong. Given your concerns about cost, you should think, too, about the additional medical expenses of monitoring a twin pregnancy and about the expenses you could incur while complications arise for the surrogate, the children, or both. One large-scale study found that hospital costs for twin pregnancies were, on average, about 5 times higher than they were for singleton pregnancies. Final note, you say you'd be devastated if your children had health issues. Yet whatever you do, there's no guarantee that they won't. When it comes to a prospective child, you'll want to do your best and be prepared for the worst. Parenthood gives you responsibility, doesn't give you control. And I'll end today with Judge John Hodgman on the tangled yarn. Aaron writes, I started crocheting during lockdown. Recently, I made the mistake of washing 7 skeins of yarn at once, turning them into a giant wad. Took 2 days to untangle 1 skein. My husband says I should throw the wad away because the time spent untangling could be better spent crocheting. Who's right? And the judge writes, Your husband seems not to understand that crochet is not primarily productive. All those headbands are just yarn gravy. Crochet is meditative. Traditionally, it was a means of passing long, empty winters by engaging your mind rather than simply losing it. And now especially, it's a gift to the introvert, a socially acceptable opportunity to break eye contact, go inward, and take a break from your husband's efficiency theories for a while. In this sense, your knot wad is just another form of cozy 3D jigsaw puzzle, and I order you to take your time with it. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine. My name is Bill McCann.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org. or by calling 303-786-7777.